It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, and it is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And I suggest you have a pencil and paper handy, because you never know when you might want to write something down here. A lot of information going to come to you in this next half hour, and you can act on some of this. I'll give you web pages and places to go. We're going to start off with a place to go. Join us for the largest climate rally in U.S. history. Millions of Americans are already feeling the disastrous effects of the climate crisis in their own lives, from coastal families hit by monster storms to drought-stricken farmers in the Midwest. It's never been clearer that we need a bold, immediate climate leadership. And that's why this President's Day weekend, February 17th, it's a Sunday, the Center for Biological Diversity, among thousands of activists, will head to the White House for the Forward on Climate rally to tell President Obama to shut down the climate-killing Keystone XL pipeline once and for all. The last time we stood up against Keystone XL, thousands surrounded the White House, and it worked. Right when every political and energy expert said the tar sands pipeline was a done deal, we beat the odds and convinced President Obama to take a year to study it. Now that year is over and the evidence is clear. It was the hottest year in American history. We experienced a terrible ongoing drought, and we felt the force of Superstorm Sandy. And still, Big Oil is pushing harder than ever for Keystone XL, looking for even more profit at public expense. So join us on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. on President's Day, February 17th from noon to 4 p.m. and make Forward on Climate the biggest climate demonstration yet. And volunteers are needed for a bighorn sheep survey. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Society for the Conservation of Bighorn Sheep are seeking volunteers to assist biologists on March 9th and 10th. That's a Saturday evening and all day Sunday. No survey experience is necessary to participate, but volunteers must attend an orientation on Saturday, March 9th at 6 p.m. at the Angeles National Forest Supervisor's office in Arcadia, California. On Sunday, volunteers will hike to designated observation sites in the San Gabriel Mountains to count and record bighorn sheep, and you'll be getting up real early. A representative from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Forest Service, or the Society will lead volunteer groups. Participants must be 16 years old and capable of hiking at least a mile in rugged terrain, although most of the survey routes are longer. In general, hikes will not be along trails. Accessing survey points will involve scrambling over boulders, climbing up steep slopes, and bushwhacking through chaparral. Sounds like a really fun time. Volunteers are encouraged to bring binoculars or spotting scopes in addition to hiking gear. Mountain weather can be unpredictable, and participants should be prepared to spend several hours hiking and additional time making observations in cold and windy weather. And you never know, in the San Gabriels, it might rain or snow. Volunteers will need to start hiking early Sunday morning. For volunteers who wish to camp, complimentary campsites will be available on a first-come, first-served basis at the Applewhite Campground on Little Creek on the night of March 9th. Surveys for bighorn sheep in the San Gabriel Range have been conducted annually since 1979. The mountain range once held an estimated 740 sheep, which made the San Gabriel population the largest population of desert bighorn sheep in California. The bighorn population declined by more than 80% during the 1980s, but it appears to be increasing now. Recent estimates have put the population at about 400 animals. Please sign up online, www.sangabrielbighorn.org. That's sangabrielbighorn.org. If you don't have access to the internet, here's some phone numbers. 626-574-5287. That's 626-574-5287. Or 909-584-9012. Let me repeat that second number for you, 909-584-9012, to receive a volunteer packet. And that sounds like a whole bunch of fun there. March 9th and 10th, Bighorn Sheep Survey down in the San Gabriel Mountains, and that might be a whole lot of fun. Here's news from our local area here. Endangered coastal fish gets 469 acres of Santa Cruz County habitat in this story by Jason Hoppen of the Scotts Valley Sea Nile. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will finalize an expansion of critical habitat for the endangered tidewater goby, a tiny fish that often finds itself in the middle of big local disputes. The brownish ephemeral creature lives in the brackish coastal marshes and lagoons that run along Santa Cruz County's coast. It is found only in California, and its unique habitat has the species threatened by climate change and development alike. In 2009, the National Resources Defense Council sued to expand the tidewater goby's habitat to more than 12,000 coastal acres, including areas where the fish are not currently found, but that one day could shelter new populations. Rising seawater will be a problem, and that's why we really important to protect the habitat they have now and the habitat they could have in the future, said Rebecca Riley, an attorney for NRDC. In Santa Cruz County, tidewater goby habitat includes Waddell Creek, Scott Creek, Laguna Creek, Baldwin Creek, Moore Creek, Corcoran Lagoon, Aptos Creek, and the Pajaro River, 469 acres in all. The San Lorenzo River, where gobies rarely have been found, was not included. Scott Creek is the only new addition to the list, with a population of fish recently being found there. The mouth of the Salinas River in Monterey County was added as a potential future home for gobies. Chris DeLith, a senior biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, said climate change was one of the factors in increasing the original habitat designation by more than 20%. He also cited it as a reason that some habitat areas now run further upstream than they once did. Locally, tidewater goby are one of several species brought up during debates about development or water policy. In 2009, they were cited as a reason why federal authorities would not allow Aptos Creek to be breached, despite winter rains that turned Rio Del Mar State Beach into a lagoon. The Santa Cruz Water Department draws water from Upper Laguna Creek, one of several parties taking water from an area deemed key for the species recovery. The department is consulting with federal authorities on a habitat conservation plan, which is nearing completion, said Chris Berry, a water resources manager with the department. Berry said the plan is focused on larger species, such as the endangered coho salmon, but that it likely would benefit the goby. Although unremarkable in appearance and living just 1 year, tidewater gobies are a unique species that live in a volatile, brackish environment. When one coastal habitat area becomes uninhabitable, the goby can take to the sea and colonize another. But development increasingly has isolated the state's low-lying marshes, with more than 90% of California's wetlands having disappeared over the years. That has made it difficult for the goby to relocate. Rising seas due to climate change also threaten to convert lagoons into sea-filled inlets, making it impossible for the goby to live. That's one reason why the Natural Resources Defense Council sought to expand the species' habitat. Part of the reason we filed this lawsuit about the critical habitat was to include more of these marshes and lagoons, to ensure that if their environment changes because of climate change or sea level rise, that there are places that they can go, that they are protected, Riley said. The critical habitat designation primarily affects projects on federal lands or that use federal dollars. They are not likely to affect private homeowners. As long as they don't have a federal nexus, it has no effect on them at all, U.S. Fish and Wildlife spokesperson Steve Henry said. And endangered coho salmon have been released into San Vicente Creek, in this story by Aaron Kinney of the San Jose Mercury News. Walter Heady, or Heady, paused to admire a pink-bellied coho salmon as it slipped from his hands and glided toward a deep pool in San Vicente Creek. "Wow, she is gorgeous," said Heady, a freshwater ecologist and researcher at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories on the shore of Monterey Bay. On a sunny morning earlier this month, Heady helped two colleagues from the National Marine Fisheries Service take a simple but important step towards restoring endangered fish to its historic habitat between the Golden Gate Bridge and Santa Cruz. The men scooped 12 salmon from a tank in a pickup truck and carried them one by one in nets to a tranquil stretch of the creek about a mile from the Pacific Ocean. On Tuesday, biologists released 8 more. The spawning-age fish, 10 females and 10 males, have a singular mission in the month or so before they die. mate, and produce nests of fertilized eggs. This is just the second year a team led by National Marine Fisheries Service has released adult salmon into San Vicente Creek, which empties into the sea through a tunnel under the scenic town of Davenport, about 10 miles up Highway 1 from Santa Cruz. Federal biologists say rebuilding the population here is essential to the survival of the coho in San Mateo and Santa Cruz counties. Now a popular sport fish, coho salmon were harvested by Native Americans who lived along the Pacific Ocean before Western settlers arrived. Central California coast coho, as the fish indigenous to this area are called, were once abundant from Mendocino to Monterey, but they are now on the brink of extinction. We haven't done this kind of scale of reintroduction in the Santa Cruz Mountains. We're kind of learning as we go and adapting as we learn, said John Ambrose, a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service who last year co-authored an ambitious plan for Central Coast coho restoration. The lessons we learn here will apply to all Santa Cruz Mountain streams, he said. The salmon used in the restoration were raised a few miles north at a hatchery run by the Monterey Bay Salmon and Trout Project, a partner in the reintroduction along the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The hatchery sits on a tributary of Scott Creek, which, thanks to the project's breeding program, is the only stream south of Marin County with a viable coho population. Reestablishing the salmon on San Vicente Creek is crucial because it will create a safety net in case a fire or other catastrophe wipes out fish at Scott Creek. The Lockheed Fire in 2009 came within 100 feet of destroying the hatchery. Once the coho have multiplied in San Vicente, biologists aim to expand the reintroduction program to some of the seven other streams in San Mateo and Santa Cruz counties that are deemed critical habitat. Last year's outplanting of three-year-old fish or broodstock was deemed a success. Researchers who surveyed San Vicente Creek over the summer counted as many as 450 young salmon. Some of the fish released January 16th bore patches of fungus on their skin. As salmon get ready to spawn, their energy shifts to reproduction, weakening their immune system. It's both an end and a beginning, National Marine Fisheries Service ecologists Joe Kernan said as he looked down at the salmon from the stream bank. It's the end of the captive broodstock and the beginning of the next generation. And help stop more post-fire salvage logging proposed in the Mendocino National Forest in this story by Kimberly Baker of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Mendocino National Forest is proposing another post-fire, quote, salvage unquote timber sale covering 300 acres in the wild and scenic Middle Fork Eel River, a key watershed that is critical for salmon recovery. Several units of the project are proposed right under the border of a recently designated wilderness. The 31,050-acre North Pass fire burned 21,693 acres at low severity and only 855 acres at high severity, making up less than 3% of the total fire area. The North Pass fire burned as a fire is supposed to do. It was a totally natural event. Nevertheless, there were 46 miles of fire line constructed during suppression efforts, most often done with bulldozers, a highly impactful means of responding to a disturbance cycle that is natural as rain in Northern California forests. The proposed project would log snag forest stands within the northern spotted owl critical habitat while damaging natural regeneration and recovery. Subsequent replanting would establish highly flammable plantation-like trees. Your voice makes a difference. Let the Mendocino National Forest know that you value post-fire habitat and ask them to stop ill-conceived plans to clear-cut our forests. And public input works. By taking action late last year with EPIC to oppose salvage logging proposed after last summer's Gough fire in the Klamath National Forest near the Oregon border, you have saved wild forests from unnecessary and damaging post-fire logging. The Klamath National Forest has canceled plans to heavily log the kangaroo roadless area. The Forest Service changed course because, one, helicopter logging was not economically viable. Klamath National Forest fire staff said that post-fire logging would not improve firefighter or community safety, and the Forest Service had heard from enough people that value the kangaroo roadless area to realize that there was nothing collaborative about a salvage proposal. Now land managers will be concentrated on fuels reduction 500 feet around private properties and roadside hazard tree logging. Because a formal proposal is not yet finalized, EPIC will continue to follow the Klamath National Forest post-fire projects related to the Gough Fire closely. But your participation makes a difference. Take action today to oppose the North Pass post-fire logging proposal on the Mendocino National Forest. Your voice helps restore a natural cycle of wildfire to the landscape. And you can find out more information, including clickable links, at www.wildcalifornia.org. That's www.wildcalifornia.org. And Idaho's roadless rule has been upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court. Anglers and hunters' most valuable places scored a win Monday when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals announced it was upholding the Idaho roadless rule. The decision was the final foreseeable hurdle for the rule and came with a very strong ruling, said Scott Stouter, roadless protection coordinator in Idaho for Trout Unlimited. We're really happy to finally have this cloud lifted from our horizon on roadless in Idaho, Strouter said. When it first started, we couldn't have predicted that this protection status would be this strong and this well supported by diverse groups in the states. Once you've focused on conflict, that's all you see. If you can unfocus on the conflict and focus on solutions, then you start to make progress. Trout Unlimited has been involved in this process since the beginning, helping to bring groups together to craft something that would protect these special places and work for the people of Idaho. Taking effect in 2008, the Idaho Roadless Rule was a community-driven answer to the issues surrounding the 2001 National Roadless Rule, community being the key word. The Idaho Roadless Rule is a demonstration of the power of collaborative stewardship, said Chris Wood, CEO of Trout Unlimited. This came about because sportsmen and women, ranchers and conservationists, county commissioners and others saw the power of common people working to solve common problems for the common good. We were all united by a common bond and a love for Idaho's backcountry areas. Wood, who participated on the advisory committee that shaped the rule over several years, added, "This decision underlies the fact that this type of conservation from the people, for the people, truly works." Idaho was one of two states, along with Colorado, to develop their own roadless rule. Colorado's rule was signed into law this past summer. The Idaho Roadless Rule protects some of the best of what's left. In Idaho, there are 9.3 million acres of roadless areas. Those areas cover 74% of salmon and steelhead spawning habitat. For the hardcore hunters, they are prime territory. About 97% of roadless areas in Idaho have hunting seasons that last more than 2 months. As a rule, Idaho tends to have a very independent spirit, so taking something like this on was no small task. But it was a necessary one, Stouter said. And now we have a rule that is strong, if not stronger, than the national rule. Roadless areas protected by the recently upheld 2001 roadless rule aren't necessarily roadless. It's much better to equate the term roadless with undeveloped. In other words, it's simply better habitat, and better habitat equals better fish, bigger game herds, and ultimately better fishing and hunting. Trout Unlimited is a nonprofit organization with more than 147,000 members, including Uncle Dennis, dedicated to conserving, protecting, and restoring North America's trout and salmon fisheries and their watersheds. If you want more information about Trout Unlimited and their projects, go to www.tu.org. That's www.tu.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Take action. Contact Montana's new governor, Steve Bullock. Buffalo Field Campaign will be meeting today with members of Governor Bullock's staff to discuss Montana's treatment of America's last wild bison and the anti-bison bills currently before the state legislature. These bills would spell disaster for America's last wild buffalo and elk. Buffalo Field Campaign has created a webpage to track these bills and enable you to take the necessary actions to prevent them from becoming law. Please contact Governor Steve Bullock and tell him that the buffalo are important to you. Remind him that wild buffalo and elk are our national heritage, and urge him to veto these anti-buffalo bills and treat the buffalo with honor and respect that they deserve. And you can find out more about that, including a clickable link at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And there's a new way to follow the work of the Buffalo Field Campaign. They have podcasts. This week, we launched the second episode of our new podcast series. Buffalo Field Campaign Coordinator Pete Bugoso discusses the Buffalo Field Campaign's new legislative page and some of the anti-bison bills that have recently been introduced in the legislature. He also discussed what it's like to be a BFC volunteer in both the West Yellowstone and Gardner camps. We will be doing new podcasts throughout the winter. You can listen to individual episodes or subscribe to our feed and stay in the loop on matters affecting the buffalo. Please subscribe and never miss an episode. And once again, go to www.buffalofieldcampaign for that podcast. And Buffalo Field Campaign's wish list includes new field volunteers and video tripods. The Buffalo Field Campaign is in need of field volunteers for the remainder of this winter buffalo protection season and for our summer education and outreach programs. If you are interested, passionate, and hardworking, please contact our volunteer coordinator. You can't volunteer but want to help anyway, donate, and we will use your contribution where it is most needed. We are also in need of high-quality fluid head video and photo tripods that we can use in the field to document the bison and their mismanagement. Contact Buffalo Field Campaign's gear coordinator with any questions about these needs and to check out our complete wish list for other needed items, which of course includes money. You can write to the Buffalo Field Campaign with a check in the envelope at Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions about their needs or if you want to contact the volunteer coordinator or the gear coordinator, telephone 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. Or visit their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign for all this information and more. And you could easily spend hours at the buffalofieldcampaign.org website. They have a really fabulous website, and I guess they now have a legislative and a podcast page, so it's even bigger than when I last looked at it. Do remember the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And let's turn to some biological diversity news. California's riverside fairy shrimp have been given critical habitat, spurred by a suit from the Center for Biological Diversity, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has finalized protections on 1,724 acres of habitat for California's riverside fairy shrimp. The protections are more than a five-fold increase from the Bush era designations and could really give the tiny crustaceans a fighting chance. Riverside fairy shrimp may be dainty, but these minuscule invertebrates, similar to the sea monkeys of comic book fame, are a cornerstone of their wetland food habitat. They hatch, grow, and breed in eggs in a single wet season of around 3 to 4 months. During dry spells, their hardy eggs can withstand temperature extremes and even survive in the stomachs of birds and other prey. The shrimp's vernal pools are disappearing and their populations are plummeting as housing developments and commercial agriculture move in. These protections will provide the minimum needed for the shrimp's survival, though 3,000 acres they live in were excluded. That's a bummer. And the National Marine Fisheries Service is saying that human population growth is a major threat to corals. NIMS recently released a sweeping and historic proposal to protect 66 corals found in American waters under the Endangered Species Act. Not only was the decision an important victory for the Center for Biological Diversity's efforts to protect corals, we petitioned for them in 2009, but it also highlighted another key feature we're working on, the impacts of runaway human population growth on plants and animals. The Fisheries Service acknowledged that corals face a variety of threats, including climate change and changing ocean waters, and then pointed out, Quote, the common root or driver of most, possibly all, of these threats is the number of humans populating the planet and the level of human consumption of natural resources, both of which are increasing in most areas around the globe. Unquote. Unfortunately, threats to corals from population growth are not diminishing. Between 2005 and 2009, the agency said human populations living within 6 miles of the coast increased 30% faster than the global average. And here's news of the weird and wild. A unicorn lair has been found in North Korea. Strange news, according to a highly suspected report from the state news agency. Archaeologists in North Korea have identified a unicorn lair, L-A-I-R, in the city of Pyongyang, said to have belonged to King Tongmyeong, a figure who, legend holds, founded the ancient Korean kingdom Goguryeo. We don't pretend to understand all the nuances at play here. Is unicorn even the right translation of the rock carving outside the alleged lair? Still, we have to admit we're intrigued. Though there was no mention of how such a lair had sat undetected in the city for more than 3 million people for so long. North Korea's state media has a knack for making overly bold statements. In this case, it has sparked a debate about language, mythology, and the origins of Korea's first capital. And a suit has been filed to protect Mexican gray wolves as endangered. The Center for Biological Diversity has sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over the agency's rejection of our 2009 policy petition to classify Mexican gray wolves as an endangered subspecies. Now protected along with other wolves in the lower 48 states, except those in the Northern Rockies and Great Lakes regions, the Southwest unique genetically distinct wolves are in desperate need of a special protection to survive and recover. Nearly 15 years after Mexican wolves were first reintroduced to the Southwest in response to a center lawsuit, there are only 58 wolves in the wild. It has been 4 years since a new wolf was released from captive breeding facilities. Meanwhile, the feds have failed to take steps recommended by their own scientists more than a decade ago to recover these struggling wolves. We're filing our second lawsuit in 3 weeks on their behalf because these very rare animals are on a razor edge of extinction, said the center's Michael Robinson. We don't want to look back in 10 years and wonder if there was anything else we could have done to save them. The center is the only group fighting for all the country's wolves. Right now, southwestern wolves are in particularly urgent peril. And 4 Northwest pocket gophers have been proposed protection. First, some good news from the pocket gopher world. 4 subspecies of these big-cheeked, small-bodied rodents of the Pacific Northwest were proposed for Endangered Species Act safeguards on Monday, following the Center for Biological Diversity's 757 settlement last year, and along with 9,234 acres of protected critical habitat. There was bad news, however. A 5th pocket gopher subspecies was declared extinct. All 5 pocket gophers live or lived in the state of Washington and are a subspecies of the Mazama pocket gopher, whose populations have plunged mostly because of the loss of prairie habitat to development and agriculture. The 4 subspecies proposed for protection are the Olympia, Roy Prairie, Tenino, and Yelm pocket gophers. The subspecies declared extinct was the Tacoma pocket gopher, which had been a candidate for protection since 2001. The centers and allies protected for these and 3 other pocket gophers in 2002. Pocket gophers get their name from the external pouches on their cheeks, with which they carry plants for food and building nests. They don't need to drink because they get enough water from plants, their home bodies seldom emerging from their burrows, but they are also key seed dispersers and hole diggers in their prairie ecosystems. And that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. Be sure and tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. And they are being recorded now, and hopefully I will tell you where they're going to be uploaded to very shortly. So stay tuned for that. And thank you for listening. And we will be back next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock with another edition of the Earth First Update.